KRWG News This Week, I'm Fred Martino. Thanks for being with us. A state district court judge this week said an effort can move ahead to try to recall Cowboys for Trump founder Coy Griffin from his seat as an Otero County commissioner on accusations of using his public office for personal gain. The judge ruled in favor of a group of recall petitioners who say Griffin repeatedly abused his authority and should be subject to a recall election this year. Griffin called the allegations frivolous, baseless, and politically motivated. He left the court proceedings abruptly to rejoin a county commission meeting and did not return. Well, speaking of that county commission meeting, KRWG News was there, virtually, of course, and a resolution to fully reopen Otero County failed during the meeting, which centered around Griffin, who advocated for a full reopening in violation of state rules. In depth, here's Madison Staten.
In a 2-1 vote, the Otero County Commission shot down a resolution calling for a 100% county reopening. Commissioner Coy Griffin, who proposed the resolution, was the only one to vote in favor of a full reopening.
I'm doing it, trying to bring representation and trying to hold the line, trying to keep people from feeling like they have to wear a mask or they're going to lose their job. It's not fair. That's why people have elected officials like us to stand in that gap.
Nora Sackett, the governor's press secretary, told KRWG in a written statement that such a measure would have had no legal effect and existing state guidelines would remain in place. Currently, Otero County is in the yellow reopening category, allowing for indoor dining at 33% capacity. New Mexico emergency public health orders carry the full weight of law throughout the state, Sackett wrote. Otero County residents can continue to progress in their fight against the virus by wearing masks, practicing social distancing, and registering for and receiving the COVID-19 vaccine when it's their turn. Eliminating county liability was a top priority for Commissioner Gerald Matherly, who voiced concern the resolution could spread litigation against the county.
If there was a person, his mom gets sick, she dies, because she said that commissioners of Otero County said we don't have to do any of this, and then they're going to turn right around and sue us for mega millions, and they'll win.
Commissioner Vicki Marquardt says she felt that voting in favor of the resolution would put a target on the back of both Otero County officials and residents. She emphasized that placing the burden of enforcement on the county sheriff would lead to rifts between state and county police.
I think we're real close to opening, so I don't know if it's worth it to do this to our businesses right now. And I certainly don't agree with this part about pitting our county sheriff against the state police. They support each other, they back each other up, and then you want them to fight over this stuff? I won't support that.
She also called Commissioner Griffin's behavior as a county representative into question, addressing him directly about his handling of county business.
Go out and you talk in front of the TV about the opening the county, which just puts a target on all of our backs. And instead of helping our businesses, now they're just focused in on us. I couldn't believe you did that. It's just that type of behavior.
Both Marquardt and Matherly have previously called for Griffin's resignation. Griffin, the founder of the political organization Cowboys for Trump, allegedly participated in the January 6th U.S. Capitol siege. While Griffin says he will not resign, his colleagues on the commission have taken steps to ratify a press statement advocating for his resignation. Griffin is questioning the legality of issuing the statement. He reflected on his actions during the meeting, speaking about both his role as a commissioner and his views on the state guidelines.
Maybe I am the bad guy, and maybe I am the troublemaker and the one that causes y'all so much distress that maybe I should just quit trying to fight. But if we're scared and we're coward to the state and live in fear, then we're going to go further and further and deeper into bondage.
For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
And stay tuned to KRWG News for the very latest on the situation involving County Commissioner Coy Griffin, who you just heard there. A state district court judge says an effort can move ahead to try to recall the Cowboys for Trump founder from his seat on the Otero County Commission. With only a few cases of COVID-19, the tiny town of Hillsboro, New Mexico, felt safe. But in February, an out-of-state construction crew moved into town, and with it came an unwelcome scare. Reporter Monica Ortiz-Yoribe with the El Paso Times brings us the story.
Two single-lane bridges have stood on New Mexico's Highway 152 east of the Black Range Mountains since 1929. Each bridge is enclosed in what looks like a steel rib cage. The Federal Highway Administration recently decided it was time to replace both bridges with double-lane overpasses. Workers began blasting away at juniper-studded foothills in February to build a detour road. The crew stationed themselves in a vacant motel at the center of Hillsboro, a historic mining town 20 miles west of the nearest interstate. Workers brought much-needed business to the only restaurant in town. They also brought the much-feared coronavirus. At least one worker tested positive for COVID-19.
The word got around town, and everybody went, damn.
Ted Calloway is a retired contractor who moved to Hillsboro a decade ago.
This is an elderly community. I doubt that there's more than a dozen people under the age of 60. I felt the risks were very high, so I did make a few phone calls.
With the help of a state representative and the New Mexico Department of Health, Calloway and his wife set up a mobile vaccination clinic in Hillsboro. It took a month to secure 100 shots of the single-dose Johnson & Johnson vaccine. On March 26th, the shots arrived at the Hillsboro Community Center in a big blue cooler. The shot goes in cold, equivalent to the temperature inside your home refrigerator. Nurse Trudy Broom delivered shot after shot for almost 5 hours straight. One of her oldest patients arrived in a wheelchair.
My name is Betty Wanick, and I'm 96.
Wanick worked as a ship welder during World War II. She performed as a singer for troops in Japan. She's also the mother of six kids.
My children have all have the shots, and now they can come and visit. Because I'm not going to be living very long, so I want to see them all.
Sherry Latassi is Wanick's oldest daughter and primary caretaker.
I'm going to shed some tears. It's a big relief for all of us. Nobody wanted to give her COVID, and that's why today is so important.
104 people got vaccinated that Friday. That's almost half the population of Hillsboro and its two neighboring communities. As the last in line took their turn, organizer Ted Calloway let out a heavy sigh. His ivory handlebar mustache was tucked behind a mask that said, "In this together."
This is the biggest gathering we've had in a year. You know, it's great to see all of my friends and neighbors here, and knowing that in a few weeks we can achieve at least a little degree of normalcy.
State health officials plan to ramp up their effort to reach rural communities this month. Federal data shows New Mexico has fully vaccinated 26.2% of its residents, the highest statewide percentage in the nation. For KRWG News and the El Paso Times, I'm Monica Ortiz Uribe.
And since Monica filed that report, some even better news. The New Mexico Department of Health announced one-third of New Mexicans, 16 and older, are now fully vaccinated. This follows the announcement that more than 50% of New Mexicans, 16 and older, have received at least a first shot. You can register for the vaccine on our homepage at krwg.org. The direct address is vaccinenm.org. In-person classes resumed this week for many students in Las Cruces Public Schools. The district prepared for the return, implementing COVID safety measures. In depth, here's Madison Staten.
Walk into a Las Cruces public school building, and it's obvious things are a little different. Partitions, shields, and temperature checkpoints are just some of the measures the district is taking in the fight against COVID-19. But the biggest change is one that can't be seen at all. Bobby Stout, the executive director of the district's physical plant department, says MERV 13 air filters have been installed across the district, helping to ensure clean air in schools. Mandated by the New Mexico Department of Education, the upgraded filters remove 75% of particles between the size of 0.3 and 1 micrometers.
It's state mandated now in every school throughout the state. We placed an order back in September of last year. We are now at approximately 95% of all of our schools have MERV rated filters. In those classrooms that don't have filters, we're employing a air purification unit.
Hermosa Heights Elementary interim principal John Coates is thankful for the increased safety measures, saying he wants kids to feel a sense of normalcy when they return to the classroom.
We're doing the best that we can for your students, trying to get back into a new sense of normal and just educate our kids the best we can.
He outlined additional wellness measures, including daily temperature checks for both students and staff. Anyone experiencing symptoms will be directed to an isolation room, designated spaces that have been constructed in all school buildings. Coates says anyone with a temperature of 100.4 or above will not be allowed to participate in classes.
When students are dropped off, temperature checks when they are exiting the school bus, if they ride the school bus, our walking students will be directed to the playground and we'll have somebody there to check their temperature. When staff come in, they'll check in the front office. We have our new temperature stands. They will take their temperature, they will sign into the building, and they're also required to sign in on an app, and it will clear them for work for that day.
The district is also taking steps to deep clean school buildings. LCPS physical plant director Bobby Stout stressed that cleaning measures are happening on a daily basis.
Custodians are cleaning constantly throughout the day, specifically on our what we call high impact or high touch areas. That is the norm across the district. We, what we call deep clean twice a week with our electrostatic spray units. We have trained our custodians to electrostatically spray to help disinfect all of our classrooms and all of our facilities.
Above all, Stout says his team is working hard to provide the safest experience possible for students.
We in my department at the physical plant, all custodians, all plant staff, and all the staff at every school are doing everything that we can to create the safest environment for your child, knowing that our children go to our schools, my grandchildren go to our schools. So it's all one big family trying to create this safe environment so that children can come back and be in school.
The full LCPS COVID-19 reporting and response plan can be found online on the LCPS website. For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
Well, of course, the COVID-19 pandemic has had a profound impact on K through 12 students, and falling behind in academics is just part of the issue. KERA's Becca Moore reports.
Being away from the classroom and learning virtually has caused a number of students to slip academically. But Cheryl English says many are also falling behind because they're not getting the social and emotional skills they typically receive during in-person instruction. She's a clinical associate professor at Southern Methodist University.
When students are missing those types of opportunities, of course, there's loneliness, and they begin to feel like, you know, am I learning? Where's the routine of the classroom?
English says that loss of interaction will affect students' future success, especially for disadvantaged youth and students of color. To counter that, she encourages students to get involved in the community, whether it be volunteering, shadowing a professional, or getting a job.
Let them work at the grocery store. Let them, you know, come into your businesses so that not only is it benefiting them, but it's also benefiting society because they're not just sitting at home trying to figure out for themselves, now where do I go?
She says that will help prepare them for the future in ways they may be missing out on in school this year. I'm Becca Moore in Dallas.
Well, as you can imagine, many schools are still requiring masks for in-person learning. But that is not the case in all Texas schools, where Governor Greg Abbott ended a statewide mask mandate. And that presents dangers for children and families, especially those with certain medical conditions. KERA's Brett Jaspers has our report.
Lindsay Walmsley spends over 2 hours a day prepping medications and giving them to her five-year-old daughter, Addie. Each vial has its own colorful name.
Orange drop. And... do you want me to sing on this one or no singing?
No singing.
No singing, okay.
Yeah. Addie has leukemia, a cancer of the blood. Drug treatments suppress her immune system. She's now in a maintenance phase of treatment. Her older brother, Noah, has been taking remote classes so he doesn't bring home any germs for things like COVID-19. He's hoping to go to in-person first grade.
Like two nights, I dreamed of it in a row.
Virtual learning has been a real challenge for Noah because he has a disorder that makes it hard to process sounds. Lindsay Walmsley says with work and doctor visits, she and her husband can't always sit with Noah at the computer.
It makes it almost impossible to learn anything of great value.
Plans to send Noah back to school in person have been in question. Their district, Birdville ISD, northeast of Fort Worth, decided it would no longer require masks for children under 10 years old when they're at their desks, so Noah could be more exposed to COVID and other diseases at school than he would have been a few weeks ago. It's a decision parents like Lindsay are wrestling with.
Do we send him and hope for the best and imagine that he will just somehow be protected, and I just don't sleep as well at night? Or do I just keep him home and absolutely devastate his world?
Other school districts like Eagle Mountain Saginaw, northwest of Fort Worth, decided to keep the mask mandate in place for everyone. Latricia and Shane Leonard live in that district. Shane is a sixth grader with sickle cell disease and asthma. When I met him, he and his mom were repping the sickle cell support group Maroon 9 with maroon t-shirts.
So your shirt doesn't match your shoes, but they match your shoes.
Because I like to match.
Shane says wearing a mask at school wasn't a big deal.
On the third day, it felt like my mask wasn't there. But and then I noticed whenever we got to lunch.
Wow.
It's kind of normal now.
I feel confident. I feel comfortable with him going.
Mom Latricia says Shane's grades were dropping with at-home school. During Christmas, she and her son both caught COVID-19. It was scary, but they recovered after mild cases. A lot is still unknown about the virus, though, especially the long-term effects. If masks weren't required at school, Latricia would keep Shane home.
If they were not wearing the mask, no. Even though he knows how to protect himself, I just think that would be a risk, you know. Yeah. That would be too big of a risk.
Children are less likely to develop severe cases of COVID-19. Dr. Nicholas Rister at Cook Children's Hospital says kids with weaker immune systems can do okay, even when they get COVID. It really depends on the specific pre-existing condition and the phase of treatment. Rister also says there's a dramatic drop in infection rates with masks in use.
You don't necessarily see the benefit. You know, we've been wearing these masks for a long time, but you don't see the infection that doesn't happen. You only see things when they do, so it's hard to realize how big of a difference you are making.
Rister says it's a really hard choice for a parent to send a child with a compromised immune system or a sibling into a school that's lifted its mask requirement. Lindsay Walmsley says going to in-person school has far higher stakes than, say, shopping in person.
Choosing to send my son to school, to me, that's a basic right. That's something that, to have equitable education for him that is safe, that's not the same as me just desiring to go into a store whenever I want without a mask on. It's just not the same.
The parents ultimately decided to send Noah to in-person first grade. They're teaching him how to keep his mask on because he might be the only one. I'm Brett Jaspers in Fort Worth.
KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, the pandemic has had a variety of effects on the border. In depth, here's KRWG public media scholar Sarah Rodriguez.
New Mexico State University's Center for Latin American and Border Studies held a virtual panel to discuss the effects of COVID-19 on the U.S.-Mexico border. One challenge involves trade. Travis Leva is the director of the New Mexico Office of Border Health.
Things to note that, you know, has been very challenging over the last year is our two major port of entries. One in Santa Teresa, which is a very high commercial port of entry for Mexico and the U.S., and then also Columbus, which, too, we do get a lot of commercial passings through that port of entry.
Leva says that New Mexico's current focus is accessibility to the vaccine.
We want to make sure that everyone has the opportunity. So some of the things that, you know, again, the interventions and what we're doing to make sure that everyone has the opportunity to get for the vaccine is we've set some community health workers, health promotion specialists, disease prevention specialists, nurse managers throughout our whole region who are helping everyone who may not be able to register or don't understand the registration process. And that's a huge feat for us because, as we know, along the border, we have very rural areas, frontier even, and we want to make sure that the opportunity, again, is for everyone throughout the state.
The New Mexico Department of Health relied on epidemiologist Melissa Limon in working with El Paso health officials in identifying binational cases.
Binational cases are people that exposed while in Mexico, especially New Mexico residents that have traveled throughout the pandemic to Mexico to visit family, to go to the doctor, to go even grocery shopping. As you know, living in the border, many people travel the border, cross the border every day, even to buy tortillas or to get medicine, to go to the pharmacy. Whatever the reason might be, we track those cases, especially they contracted COVID-19.
The panel also included Dr. Georgina Delgado, director of IMSS Hospital in Ciudad Juarez. Dr. Delgado explained the different trends there. Ciudad Juarez currently has around 30,000 cases with about 2,800 deaths. Juarez also saw a large spike of COVID-19 cases during January and February, and cases are slowly starting to decline again. There is some good news. Delgado says vaccines are beginning to be distributed throughout Mexico. There has been over 5,700,000 vaccines distributed throughout Mexico, but only 734,000 of these distributions are the complete vaccine. With a low percent of the population being vaccinated, health officials are relying on COVID-19 safe practices such as the use of face masks, social distancing, and only going out for essential purposes to help slow the spread of COVID-19 in Mexico. San Diego and Baja California also see a lot of commercial traffic through their U.S.-Mexico ports of entry. University of California San Diego professor Dr. Linda Hill describes how San Diego County has handled COVID-19.
When we look at how did we do in terms of what are the COVID rates in San Diego and Baja, it's really difficult to compare because we were using different systems. So in San Diego, testing became more widely available as time went on, and both symptomatic and asymptomatic people had access to testing, and it then became required for work and school and procedures. What our colleagues told us in Baja was that they were approaching a COVID testing in a different way and using a sentinel methodology, sort of more of an epidemiologic approach.
As the COVID-19 pandemic continues to affect the U.S.-Mexico border, health officials remind the public to continue COVID-safe practices. For KRWG Public Media, I'm Sarah Rodriguez.
Well, now a concern during the pandemic and really any time, Texas is one of only 12 states that failed to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. And it's also the state with the largest number of uninsured people in the nation. As Roz Brown reports from the Texas News Service, the recent stimulus bill includes incentives to expand Medicaid, and advocates are calling on the state to do just that.
Laura Guerra Cardis with the Children's Defense Fund Texas believes lawmakers should act now on expansion to make Texas a better place to live and work.
Our leaders can and must rise above politics and expand Medicaid. Anything short of expansion, we think, is simply playing politics with people's lives.
The relief package would pay each state's 10% share of the Medicaid costs for the next 2 years and give them additional money to cover people who are uninsured. Adam Searing is a health policy research professor with Georgetown University. He says in many states, healthcare coverage has gone from bad to worse during the pandemic. His data shows children in states that expand Medicaid are twice as likely to have health coverage.
The sad thing is, over the last 5 years, our progress in ensuring children has turned around. You know, while we have done a good job overall in ensuring kids across the country, we shouldn't be going backward.
Texas has long had the highest uninsured rate in the country. Nearly 13% of Texas children are uninsured, compared with less than 2% in Massachusetts, which expanded Medicaid 8 years ago. Guerra Cardis says when parents are uninsured, children also suffer.
In Texas, we have a children's health insurance crisis, where over the last about 3 years, we have reversed course and started seeing our child uninsured rate grow pretty dramatically.
Should Texas expand Medicaid now, the state would stand to gain $3 to $5 billion in federal aid over a two-year period. For Texas News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
More big news from Texas this week. It actually is making national news. Texas Democratic leaders are blasting voting bills advancing through the Republican-led state legislature. Houston Public Media's Andrew Schneider has that story.
Senate Bill 7 and House Bill 6 would ban 24-hour voting and drive-through voting, as well as remove restrictions on partisan poll watchers. Mayor Sylvester Turner said those changes and others amounted to what he called Jim Crow 2.0.
The Texas Rights Project, and I want to thank the representatives for being here today, states the extended voting hours in Harris County were mostly used by people of color. 56% of voters who cast ballots in late night hours were Black, Hispanic, or Asian. In addition, Black voters and other voters of color were more likely to be victims of poll watcher intimidation.
Harris County Commissioner Rodney Ellis echoed Turner, calling the bills a modern-day poll tax. He called on business leaders to pressure Republican lawmakers to block the bills. Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick previously blasted such pressure from companies including American Airlines and Dell. I'm Andrew Schneider in Houston.
Well, as you just heard, in Texas and across the nation, Republicans have introduced bills to restrict voting access. Some thoughts now from commentator Peter Goodman.
Republicans dislike majority rule so much that they've introduced more than 300 bills in 47 states to undermine it. Significant voter fraud is an urban myth. The conservative Hoover Institute reviewed decades of records and found no such thing. Former New Mexico Secretary of State Deanna Duran sent the state police 64,000 possible voter fraud cases and struck out. And the Trumpists' scores of lawsuits in 2020 yielded nothing. Individual voter fraud just ain't worth it. It carries criminal penalties, and the vote is unlikely to change anything. Absentee ballot fraud is tough, and organizing group fraud would almost surely land somebody in jail. So why are Republicans doing this? Well, white U.S. citizens are fast becoming a minority. That's imminent in Georgia and Texas. Yet the Republican Party keeps having older white males in most leadership positions. Under Trump, they relied on overt racism and xenophobia. No wonder Republicans always lose the national popular vote. Therefore, the hundreds of bills designed to make voting harder, particularly in progressive cities like Atlanta. Georgia's 98-page SB 202 has some innocuous provisions and some administrative improvements that most county clerks would appreciate, but it also makes voting harder by starting early voting later then by limiting drop boxes to one per county and closing them in the crucial last days before Election Day. That ain't going to shorten voting lines in Fulton County. And once you're in that line, folks who bring you water risk criminal penalties. Remember Trump trying to bully the Georgia Secretary of State, an independent elected official, to negate Georgians' majority for Biden? Trump also asked state legislators to step in, but they couldn't. So SB 202 changes the composition and powers of the state election board, making it a mere tool of the Republican-controlled legislature. The Secretary of State is no longer chairman and doesn't even have a vote. Republican politicians, not voters, will choose the chair. They'll choose four of the five members, and the Democratic Party will choose one. The Republican-controlled board will also have more power to intervene if the board thinks a county election board is underperforming. Hello, Fulton County. County election boards certify results and decide challenges to voters' eligibility. Now the state election board can replace county boards where results are unsatisfactory to the Republican state legislators. Next time some would-be dictator tells them to find 11,000 more votes, they'll say, "Yes, sir. How about 22,000? They haven't revived the literacy test, whereby dark-skinned voters used to have to recite the Constitution from memory to qualify. Not yet, anyway.
Peter's opinions are his own and do not necessarily represent the views of KRWG or NMSU. If you ever miss one of Peter's columns on KRWG News, no worries, we have you covered. You can always find his work in the local viewpoints section at krwg.org. Well, on KRWG-TV, a new season of Fronteras, a Changing America, kicked off this week. On the first episode of the season, we learned more about a new dental school in the borderland. Anthony Moreno talked with Dr. Richard Black. He is dean of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center, El Paso Woody Hunt School of Dental Medicine.
Dr. Black, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Anthony. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
Can you share with us a little bit about the mission of the school and what it's going to offer the area?
Well, I think the mission of the school is the same mission as the Health Sciences Center that we belong to here at Texas Tech, and that is two major things. One is to educate future healthcare leaders, and the second thing is to take care of the population that's very unique to southern New Mexico and the borderlands. Texas Tech University System, which is the third largest system in Texas, made the decision politically and financially to establish a dental school in western Texas. So they picked the largest population area, which would include Las Cruces and Juarez for that matter, and said, let's put the dental school where we need it the most, and that is in an area that's very underserved as far as general dentists as well as specialists. All of southern New Mexico is underserved as compared to national numbers, and certainly all of western Texas is underserved. So the idea is that students tend to stay and practice where they train, which is one way to explain why almost 60% of the licensees in Texas practice in five counties. And three of those counties out of the five happen to be where the dental schools are currently: Houston, Dallas, and San Antonio.
I want to talk a little bit about the need for the region to have more dental professionals in the area. I know you contributed to an op-ed in the Dallas Morning News in 2018 stating that 54 counties in Texas have no dentists, and most of them are located in West Texas. Can you share a little bit more about the need?
Yeah, it's a tremendous problem. You know, everything that you would consider to be west of I-35 is considered to be western Texas, and that includes some pretty big cities like Amarillo, Lubbock, Midland, Odessa, Abilene, San Angelo, El Paso. We have some bright people that come from our area, but what happens to them is we don't get them back after they go down and train. Either they are impressed with that part of Texas, there's more opportunity possibly. They meet someone down there, and so they end up staying. There was a study that we did for the legislature that showed out of 10 years of the three dental schools graduating 300 students a year, so that's 3,000 students. Over 10 years, we only had 22 dentists return to Western Texas out of all those dentists. So the idea that they don't have a dentist in 54 counties is true. They also don't have a physician or a nurse practitioner or a Walmart, for that matter. So, you know, it's not that Western Texans or Southern New Mexicans, you know, are not resilient. They know, they try to find health care where they can, but there are places now where there's simply not a dentist for 200 miles and people have to try to drive there. And that's part of the problem of why we have the kind of chronic health conditions that we do in our part of the world, is we just don't have access to really good care. And if we don't have transportation, we don't have a high dental IQ, there's not a dentist in town, people tend to not go. 50% of El Paso County is being registered as not seeing a dentist on a regular basis, maybe never. And we do know that if your oral health is poor, your overall health is going to be poor. So if you have some of the chronic conditions that we see in our part of the world, obesity, diabetes, metabolic syndrome, cancer, all of that's going to be worse if you don't have access to good oral health care, and then use that access to make sure you have good oral health.
Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Richard Black. He is the dean of the Woody Hunt School of Dental Medicine at Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. Thank you so much again for joining us.
Thank you, Anthony.
And you can watch that full interview tomorrow morning at 11:30 on KRWG-TV. A year ago, the StoryCorps Military Voices Initiative visited Las Cruces, and every week we are presenting portions of those interviews. Today, Air Force Colonel Wendy Woodard is interviewed by her husband, Scott.
I started at the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs. After that, I went to Vance Air Force Base in Enid, Oklahoma, nice, for pilot training. After pilot training, I went to Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana to fly the B-52, and then went to McGuire Air Force Base in New Jersey to fly the KC-10. I did a decent amount of time overseas during that assignment. Following that, I got to go back to the Air Force Academy as an officer and teach. Where'd I go then? Oh, Robins Air Force Base in Georgia, where I met you.
Oh.
And now we are here in New Mexico at New Mexico State.
Tell me a little bit about maybe some challenges that you think you might have faced along the way.
I would say that pilot training was probably the most challenging year of my life. Definitely found something I wasn't good at, and that was learning how to fly. And it took a lot of time after that to build myself back up, I think.
Okay. Did you find any difficulty as a female?
I don't think that my problems, my issues, my challenges were due to being a woman. I think that it was just due to my skill level. Mm-hmm. I did have one person in my 23 years of active duty tell me that I didn't belong in the cockpit. And I was so mad because no one had said it. And then this guy ruined it for everybody else by saying it.
What was your earliest memory where you realized that you wanted to be in the Air Force, in the military, as a pilot?
I think it was about the fourth grade. Prior to that, we had lived next door to some people who had a picture of the Dallas Cowboys team with the cheerleaders in front, and they had the most excellent uniforms.
Wow.
And so that's kind of where I was prior to seeing that plane, that I wanted to be a Dallas Cowboys cheerleader.
Who doesn't?
Well, I don't know. And so I was, you know, torn between Dallas Cowboys cheerleader or pilot. And I have a feeling, now that I'm a parent, I have a feeling that my parents looked at each other and thought, we could encourage one of these.
Yeah.
And I think I know which one it should be.
So how would you compare the Air Force or the military as a whole now as it was when you first entered?
It's funny to say this, but there are a lot more women. Again, that's not what I'm looking for. I'm not looking to see, I'm not counting heads. But it's cool to see more women in the military itself taking leadership roles. I think that we have changed to a focus of a lot more inclusion and wanting our force to look like the people we defend. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really important. That's obviously decisions above my pay grade.
Where do you see the future? A lot of unmanned aircraft is starting to become popular.
Yeah.
Do you see a point where there will no longer be pilots in the sky?
Yeah, I think that that's coming in our lifetimes. Combat. I don't think passenger planes.
Well, I don't know if I would get on a plane as a pilot.
I was going to say, would you get on a plane without a pilot?
What do you think you would tell? And obviously, you speak to young ladies on a regular basis right now who are interested in this.
Well, I think one of the best things about the military is that I don't have to fight for equal pay. I know that I get paid exactly the same thing as my male counterparts. The opportunities for progression are, I would like to say, unlimited. Mm-hmm. I would say that there is room to grow and make mistakes. No one expects you to know how to do everything perfectly, but they expect you to learn from your mistakes. But it's okay to make mistakes.
Yeah.
And that's something that I really struggled with. I think that was a big portion of my pilot training struggle, is that I didn't think it was okay to make mistakes.
So you are now officially a Colonel Select. Where do you see yourself in 5 years?
Oh, I think we'll be retired in 5 years. And then you and I will figure out what the rest of our lives holds.
Jet skis. But wherever it is, we'll be there together and we'll make the most of it.
Yeah, yeah.
Woodard became a colonel since that interview was recorded. To hear that segment, as well as the full interview and many other StoryCorps conversations, go to the StoryCorps page in the radio section at krwg.org. Funding for this segment provided by the Heritage Assisted Living, taking COVID-19 precautions and offering specialized care for their residents, accepting admission in their 3 sanitized homes. More at 575-525-9215 or heritage-lc.com. In focus on the program this week, Madison Staton continues her conversation with the Sierra Club's Camilla Feibelman. This segment begins with Feibelman's thoughts on the Energy Transition Act, which is designed to make sure we get more renewable energy in the state of New Mexico.
So what the Energy Transition Act does is, first, it says utilities have to provide us with electricity that is increasingly generated with higher percentages of renewable energy. Then once we start to leave coal, there are going to be special incentives to ensure that that replacement is renewable energy, but also that it's placed up in the Four Corners area to help replace that tax base. It's going to be done in a way that is cheaper for customers who are paying for that electricity, and it's going to generate funds to help workers that are going to be losing their jobs, and to develop funds for communities to help reimagine their local economies in ways that are more sustainable. So it doesn't deal, like, for example, with carbon emissions that come from transportation or from buildings or from oil and gas specifically, but it does do just an incredible job in helping to look at how to facilitate a just transition in our electric sector.
Absolutely. And like you said, we've talked a lot about and heard a lot about critics of the act that are worried about the loss of jobs that might come from the switch in resources. Can you touch a little bit more on some of those protections that the act provides?
Sure. I mean, the first thing to know is that PNM had already announced that it would be leaving the San Juan Generating Station when we began with many, many sectors to conceptualize the Energy Transition Act. So this was an attempt to say, hey, we know this place is going to shut down. We know that people are going to be losing their jobs. What can we do to soften that hard blow? So the Energy Transition Act is not what is shutting down these coal-fired power plants. It's the larger global economics for coal. It's the fact that energies like renewable and wind are just cheaper and more flexible. You know, some people like to claim, oh, you know, sunlight, wind, it's too intermittent. Well, you know, combined with battery storage, it does pretty well. And if you look at these aging coal-fired power plants, they're not that reliable either. You know, they have accidents that have them shut down. They're not as efficient as they used to be. At the mine, the coal burns with less efficiency now because it's not sort of the best coal that we got out early at the life of the plant. So you know, you could not do the Energy Transition Act and just let the Four Corners, you know, weather the storm itself. But what this does is to really incentivize the utilities rebuilding their energy up in the area. One thing that people don't know is, you know, the jobs have kind of slowly but surely gone away because two of the four stacks at the San Juan Generating Station had already closed several years ago, and they're sort of ramping down the production as they go. You know, if you don't do anything at all, well, then the utilities build it somewhere else. The problem with that is, you know, the jobs are one impact, but the question of the tax base, that property tax that's generated from having an operating plant there, can have a big impact on the economy. And so by incentivizing the rebuilding of new renewable energy and battery storage in the area, you're replacing that tax base, which may have you know, a bigger impact even. And the estimates are showing that with the renewables that will replace the coal-fired power plant, we're going to have over $1 billion investment up in the Four Corners area.
And we know that New Mexico isn't stopping at just the Energy Transition Act. The state legislature voted this session to create a sustainable economic task force, which will aim to help workers most impacted by a switch to a clean energy economy. Can you tell me more about what this task force will actually do?
Yeah, well, one thing to know and recognize is that Representative Angelica Rubio, who comes from Southeast New Mexico, back in 2019 was part of the coalition building the Energy Transition Act, but she realized that we needed to not just sort of act on economic moves forward, but we really needed to study the situation and understand what frontline workers wanted to be doing, what opportunities they saw for transition. So she, with some of the discretionary funds that legislators get, paid for a study out of the Department of Workforce Solutions that ended up interviewing 1,800 people around the state to identify, you know, what would these alternatives and long-term solutions look like. And so that study has now been done, and it's time to follow up. It's time to start implementing these programs, working with community colleges, ensuring that the educational programs are multilingual and accessible to different communities. So we don't have the exact and specific solutions. We think that that would actually be a bit disingenuous. We actually need to go through a process of understanding what alternatives are there out there for us. And, you know, one really interesting thing that we heard from people in Southeast New Mexico especially was like, you know, we don't want our only economic development to be private prisons and oil and gas and maybe high-level nuclear waste storage. We want economic opportunities that really sustain and build and make our communities attractive and safe and healthy to live in. And so that's what ultimately SB 112, which was the combination of two bills, it was kind of just transition that will lead us to a sustainable economy, which we're hoping the governor will sign and that her agencies have been supportive of. What those bills don't do, however, are deal with really comprehensive climate change and carbon reduction. So we had hoped to pass HB 9, which would have combined the economic path forward with enshrining the governor's climate executive order in law. Unfortunately, the agencies really felt like they didn't have enough funds to really do that work properly and do all the needed rulemaking. So another thing that we focused on a lot in this session was ensuring that our environmental agencies actually have the money that they need, not just to permit, but also to inspect and to enforce and to make sure that the industries coming here to New Mexico are treating our people right and making sure that they're truly good neighbors. So there's still more to do, but thankfully the administration is moving forward on implementation of their climate executive order. Next order of business for us is to make sure next time around it's enshrined in law.
And then Senate Bill 8 was also passed this legislative session, which will allow the state of New Mexico to set more stringent air quality regulations. Why is something like this so important, Camilla?
Yeah, well, anybody who tracks our work, and you know, hopefully people do, will know that we have really dedicated ourselves to trying to reduce methane waste and pollution. People hear methane. What is that? Well, methane is basically natural gas, and it leaks out of oil and gas operations, both oil and gas operations, at every part of the process, from the fracking process to the extraction process to the distribution process to the refinement process. And methane, it just so happens, is one of the most potent global warming gases that there are. It's 89% more potent as a global warming gas over a 20-year period. And New Mexico, as you may have seen in the satellite imagery, has the major methane leak and waste hotspot in the entire country. And that's over the Four Corners area. But with the oil boom in the southeast, there is a lot of leakage and waste there. So not only is this a huge climate issue, but it also means limited royalties coming into the state, because that wasted methane gas is not charged the royalty rates. So we had worked with the Obama administration to see really strong methane waste regulations that were part of our Paris climate agreements. Those were rolled back by the Trump administration, although we were able to slow that process. And the governor has committed to nation-leading ozone and methane standards. We're halfway there with some really good methane standards coming out of the Oil Conservation Division, but we need strong ozone standards. And the draft proposal for those rules were a little bit weak, you know, with some loopholes that we think and hope will be fixed when the final rule comes out in May. Now, that was a long-winded way of saying there is a problem with our air quality standards here in New Mexico, which is the Air Quality Act says that our New Mexico air regulations can't be any stronger than federal rules, which is a huge problem when you have an administration and now out of office that gutted over 100 different environmental regulations. So with the governor's signature, the state would be able to do air quality rules stronger than the federal rules, and it would mean that they weren't limited to just regulating smog in ozone-heavy counties that are close to exceeding the federal rule.
The Sierra Club's Camilla Feibelman talking with KRWG's Madison Staton. You can watch that entire interview on the Newsmakers page. You'll find it in the local TV section at krwg.org. That's KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino. Thanks so much for joining us for the program. Broadcasting from New Mexico State University, KRWG Las Cruces, and KRXG Silver City.